Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. His name is Topper, John Topper Johns of Prairie Village. He's a lawyer, an adventurer, a lover of theater, a mountaineer, and a philanthropist. Topper Johns is also something else, one of the most prolific art collectors in the Midwest. Pieces by Matisse and de Kooning, Picasso, Degas, Warhol, Cezanne, and Renoir cover his walls. In fact, he has so many paintings by so many masters that some hang at about knee level. He's also a great chronicler of his exploits, keeping tabs of memories that range from President Eisenhower once admiring his tie to the time he bungee jumped out of a hot air balloon over the Rocky Mountains. He's a Kansas City original. Eric Adler just wrote about him in The Star, and Topper Johns joins me now in the studio. And so good to have you here, Topper.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually people who own these pieces by all these great masters keep it a secret because they don't want anyone breaking into their home. But, well, here you are.
Well, I know it, and my wife may feel a little differently about that. You're absolutely right. There are a lot of fine collections in Kansas City that where people just don't want them mentioned at all.
You don't know about them.
No.
But you don't mind.
No, I think that it's hard to fence art. I found that in the practice of law, actually, that a couple of my clients, believe it or not, I'm not defending them, but I found out later that they were buying art that was stolen. But that's pretty rare. Most of the time, if somebody breaks in, they don't want the art. They're looking for jewelry or TVs or whatever.
Well, and just for the record, you do have a security system
that keeps tabs
of these things.
Right, and the real problem, of course, that you worry about is fire, not so much theft.
Oh, sure.
Not so much theft.
But how do you deal with that? How do you protect art from a fire?
Well, you insure it, and any time you insure individual pieces as opposed to just a lump sum number, it's there's an expense there. There's a carrying expense, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, when did you catch the collecting bug, Topper? How did this happen?
I'm not sure exactly, but I think, Eric Adler hit it when he said, I don't know if it's a high-end hoarder, but I've probably been a hoarder all my life, and that's not a good way to put it.
At least we can acknowledge that.
Right, yes, yeah. Exactly. I think my wife and I started collecting. We were married in 62, and then probably within 2 or 3 years after that, we're doing it. But we started buying it, what was the predecessor to Sotheby's in New York in 1969, so a long time ago.
So you would go to
the— Yes, we would go.
You'd go to the auctions?
And I am uncommon enough that it is not good for me to be there in person because I remember twice on occasions— they have called me out during the bidding saying, sir, you already have the bid. It would go back. It's not like an auction where they're trying to pump something up.
Yeah.
They just simply say lot number 509, and it may be a Picasso or whatever. And they'll simply start in and say, the lady on the left has the bid, the gentleman on the right, boom, and just back and forth like that. And finally, they just quickly say, and it could go for millions of dollars, and within less than a minute, they'll simply say, final warning, gentleman on the right has it. And that's it. It's done.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I'd get involved, and I would somehow not even realize that I already had the bid. And then I bid against myself on two different occasions. And one other, just quickly, this is totally unrelated, but I once thought I was buying at auction George Washington's Bible. And I wasn't there in person this time. This is just a screw-up that's kind of interesting, at least to me at the time. So anyway, I got it. And there's a way you can check to see right after the auction if you've got it, actually during the auction. And then I started reading the description. I should have realized just that the estimate, they always show an estimate of the value. Well, it was Martha Washington. She was from the Curtis Lee family.
Yes, sure.
Totally different
Not
deal.
Not the same thing.
Yeah, and I immediately called. It was Sotheby's or Christie's or somebody back there and fessed up. And they fortunately knew who the underbidder was. And so I paid the difference between what that bidder had bid and what I had won the object for. And I don't own whatever that was.
Well, is all of this art collecting, Topper, is it an obsession? And how much of it is just love of art?
Well, that's who knows? I'd love to say it's 100% the
love of art.
The appreciation of the aesthetics. There's got to be There's got to be an unhealthy amount of obsessive compulsive behavior there, I'm afraid.
But at least you acknowledge it. And
yes, right.
This is your hobby. This is your great
joy.
It's
interesting that I've so many of my friends are retired or are retiring, and they wonder, you know, what happens to my time, and I can never account for it exactly. But certainly, you know, I have bids in quite often, and not as we speak actually, but more often than I'd care to admit, or care to admit to my wife, at these auction houses, especially in New York, but also in Chicago and San Francisco and Los Angeles, and so just checking on them, you know, yeah, is a time consumer.
Well, how do you determine what you want, and to what extent do you do your own sort of hunting for the pieces that you're looking for yourself versus having an agent do it for you?
Yes, I do. I do it all myself. I really admire the art dealers, and it's really got to be a labor of love, because it's not, well, you know, they say that one of the most career-shortening events that can happen in a banker's life is to lend money to somebody starting a restaurant or a bar. I think that one lower in terms of risk would be art galleries. Typically, it's what they do for love. It truly mm-hmm. is. And they do have a feel for it. And why I don't know. There's something about me. I may be just a control freak nature or whatever. I tend not to. I did buy from Myra Morgan, was a dealer here for years during the, really up until fairly recently. She was, her son's maybe still in the business, but in general, I've done it myself. It's a long way of saying I either buy at auction, or I'm going over after this to Kansas City Art Institute, because they have their semi-annual sale starting at 5 o'clock today. Little pitch for them. It's a wonderful thing, really,
sure,
because Kansas City Art Institute is just a terrific Kansas City jewel. It's one of the top 10
sure.
art colleges in the nation. Speaking of that, I started going there when they only sold ceramics. And I kept saying that this is the best way to get yourself known in the community is to show off your work at the mm-hmm. end of each semester, which they now do in all the departments. And it's but anyway, that's one way place where I take an initiative. And then I likewise do with regard to buying art and lamps at auction. I will call back and talk to the experts back there mm-hmm. about the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And
Topper Johns is our guest. He's one of Kansas City's most prolific art collectors. His story was chronicled in Last Sunday Star by Eric Adler. You know, you have 12 signed Pablo Picassos. How did you wind up with 12 Picassos?
Well, they were bought at auction. And we sold 43 pieces about 5 or 7 years ago.
Is that hard for you?
It is. Well, I'll tell you, I did it as a bucket list thing, kind of like this list of things that I've done, bizarre things through the years. It was just something I wanted to be able to say I did, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But we sold 4 Picassos there. So there we go to, you know, 16 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the best one. You know, there's a story along those lines, and I know you're probably trying to keep this on a certain.
I'm known for going off on some tangents.
Well,
I'm
here, a tangent.
That's just fine,
unfortunately, I'm a tangent guy. But when we were selling these, three things were interesting about it. Three different pieces. The most unusual situation was that we sold 4 Warhols. But one of them, the most valuable, that they'd taken to, they took to Tokyo and to Hong Kong and to Moscow, trying to get interest and all. And I don't remember the light that you use, but you use some sort of photo, whatever light, and you can see what's underneath it and all.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had, heaven knows why, but I had just slightly, in my opinion, enhanced it. but anyway, so it comes out in the condition report, and I should have known that that's the case. It was just.
What do you mean you had enhanced it?
Well,
what
I had taken a ballpoint pen.
Get out of here!
I know. Oh, listen. Everybody that knows me tells this story to everybody else they know because so
you
as a result
it a little bit.
So as a result, it did not sell. It did not reach. Typically, the estimates. You had a low estimate, a high estimate that are published. And if you'll go within two-thirds of the low estimate, usually the individual, the consignor, will not have put a reserve lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this didn't even get to the reserve. Now, I've since been told about a restorer over at the Nelson. And so they were very minor. And, you know, his
what
work—
What exactly did you do to it?
Well—
Just like clean up the face a little bit?
It was a Mao. You know, he did Mao. And the big Mao, this was a very small Mao, but the big Mao, they had a big Mao that went for $114 million on a private sale.
Yeah.
So they're, it's valuable. But the other two things real quick in terms of this sale work, two of them came back because they were fakes. And one of which, one was a Zuniga, the other was an August Rodin, and I'd bought them all at either Sotheby's or Christie's. So, but they only give you a 6-year guarantee on the theory, I guess, that the consignor is long gone and they couldn't get it back anyway. But the August Rodin was owned by Geraldine Rockefeller Dodge, who was not only John D. Rockefeller's sister, but she was married to the Dodge automobile magnate. And so you'd think she knew what she was doing, or had. Speaking of agents, and I think that's maybe how we got off on this tangent.
Right.
Was you would have thought she would have known, and then where it was either Sotheby's or Christie's, and they put their imprimatur on it too. But the guy from the reigning expert in Rodin would come over from Paris, not just to see this piece, but a lot of pieces around. And either authenticate them or not, and he would look and he'd say, "Look, I know it's not posthumously cast. I know it's his foundry, but there's just something. There's a book called Blink that the people who look at things enough, they don't even know why.
You know exactly on your first impression
if it's
real or
and
not."
And he kept saying he wasn't sure, and finally, after about 2 years of coming back 3 or 4 times, he finally, and of course, Sotheby's wanted it. They wanted it to be as real as I wanted it to be real because they said they couldn't sell it otherwise. And anyway, it turned out it was he decided it was done, you know, in his lifetime in his foundry, but probably his students finished it off and he didn't. Heaven knows how he.
Well, the art world is full of all of this.
It is. It is. It's amazing.
You're constantly navigating what's real and authentic from what's fake, right?
I worry about, you know, we buy Tiffany lamps and I got one recently that had not gone for.
By the way, just for the record.
What's that?
I'd like to buy one, but I don't buy them.
Right.
Just,
well,
you buy them, I don't. Yeah.
Getting them shipped is a big thing because you're always worried about the shade.
The packing for one of those probably costs more than what I earn in a year.
You know,
right?
That's very insightful of you, Steve. It's exactly right.
Start crying
it almost
now,
does.
Topper.
It almost does. But this one was a piece that had not gone within range, and I thought the range was very modest. I mean, reasonable, and I had not been on it. But they called me, knowing what a sucker I am, and I ended up buying it. But and I have it now, and it's got all the markings and everything. They're just, but my blink sense says
something's off. Something's off.
There was there were some sophisticated buyers, bidders. So I'm hoping that they.
When you go out and you're shopping for a new piece, are you going just based on gut instinct, or do you go out looking for a certain piece by a certain artist because that's what you want to sort of round out a collection?
It's the gut instinct. When I'm just going to antique stores or galleries or Kansas City Art Institute or wherever, I'm just looking for something that I find attractive. And frankly, it's much the same in auctions. You know, they have catalogs both online as well as paper catalogs.
Yes.
And, you know, there's certain things you can really sense are going to be pretty much like what you see if you're just looking at a catalog or whatever. And there's others that through time, you get the experience to know that
when you see them in person, they
really can disappoint, or at least be very unusual. I also buy a fair amount of jewelry, frankly, at auction. And I don't know if you've got any listeners out here who sell jewelry retail, and they may argue with me on this, but the difference between buying jewelry at auction in New York, for example, at Sotheby's Christie's, not only do you know that they've graded it about as fairly as they possibly could, but it is it's just at an entirely different price level than it is through retail, and you can understand that that would be the case. But in any event, I will, before I buy jewelry, I'll ask them to, if say it's a ring, to put it on some hand model, so to speak, photograph it from several angles and send it, and you'd be amazed that occasionally you'll see the ring from a certain angle, and speaking of blink, I mean, you'll just blink in a very negative way. You'll say, oh, my gosh, that's shockingly bad.
Again, our guest, John Topper Johnson, is in our studio this morning. He's one of Kansas City's most prolific art collectors. He's also a great adventurer. We'll talk about some of that in our second half today. You know, of all the, Topper, of all the grand master painters out there, you know, over the centuries, is there one whose work you just sort of, even today, you covet and sort of desire more, you wish you had more in your collection today?
Well, the biggest, I think the greatest artist, what makes an artist great apparently, and I certainly don't pretend to really know, but art, I think, can be defined in a very broad sense of being just manipulating materials in a manner that means that people will react emotionally to.
Yeah,
nothing
sure.
more nor less than that. However, really fine art has to really catch the right critic's eye. It has to be idea filled. It has to be cutting edge in terms of the way perhaps it's being made as well, and certainly in terms of the ideas behind it. And I don't pretend to be. In fact, I think there's another digression. In both the performing arts and the visual arts, there's an awful lot of caprice, an awful lot of just sheer luck as to who makes it and who doesn't. Tom Cruise is a very fine actor, but there are many that are almost as good or better, and they just didn't have that break. But however arbitrary you think it is to pick out one tap dancer who made it big and the others who didn't, it's even more so, I think, in the visual arts. You have to get the right critics saying the right things about you. You have to get the right dealer. You typically really, as many fine artists we get in Kansas City Art Institute, you almost need to go to New York finally. But anyway, that's my way of saying that I have to be told sort of after the fact. Somebody has to have anointed the piece. And I do think, though—
That helps you in how you regard
it yourself.
Right.
Oh, absolutely. Sure. Mm-hmm. And I do think that the biggest leap that I can recall, I'm sure Picasso certainly was too, but would be Auguste Rodin. There was a guy named Henri Chaput who was the great French and probably the great sculptor right before him. He died. Up comes and so they turned this job over. It was going to be a tribute to Balzac that he was working on. Anyway, Rodin does it in a very awkward, strange, dramatic way, but he was just able to change so dramatically things.
So his work you'd like to have more of.
Yeah, right.
How about contemporary artists?
Oh, you know, I fear questions like, if you were a tree, what's your favorite tree?
And
I'm do
not
think,
going there today.
I do
Don't
think
worry.
That, you know, that...
I have a feeling you could handle it, even if I asked it, too.
Yeah, no. Picasso... Picasso comes to mind, of course, but you know, I'm sorry, I just don't know any money that I feel particularly strong about. We sold a nice de Kooning, and he's certainly, you know, the abstract expressionist. Right after World War II in 1945, the art world, which had been in Paris forever and ever, switched to New York. It's really something that happened, and it's really stayed in New York.
Yeah,
but a lot of it due to these abstract expressionists.
I mean, how often, you know, late at night, you know, Topper, do you walk through your home and just sort of gaze at what
I do that, believe it or not.
For your own home.
It is. If somebody were to say that there is a phoniness involved in my collecting, and I don't think that's an entirely inaccurate call, I would say that it's right in the sense that I don't study. You should see me go through museums. My wife Linda and I go through wherever we travel. We travel a lot. We will go to all the major museums there. Well, I go through it like I have no interest, so to speak, but truly I do. I just don't I'm a type A personality, and I don't study them very thoroughly. So from that point of view, my collecting is not very, very valid, but my enjoyment is truly valid. I mean, I truly look at that stuff. We have house cleaners that'll move something just slightly, and I know it immediately. I told Eric that it was over 800 pieces, but I'm sure that there's got to be very close to 1,000.
Maybe down in the basement somewhere, in the garage.
Well, what I did is I counted through a certain number of rooms, and I got nearly 600, and there were so many more rooms left that I could tell that was easily over 800. But there's a lot of them, but I almost guarantee you I could tell you if any one of them's been slightly touched.
You know, in his piece on you in the newspaper, Eric Adler pointed out that your wife once laid down the law, Topper, and said that for every piece you buy, you had to get rid of one you already had. How effective was she?
No, she wasn't, unfortunately. I mean, bless her heart. I mean, my wife is really a beautiful, smart woman. But I'll tell you, her very strongest attribute is her great mental health. She has put up with this, and actually, she enjoys art very much, very much. It's not, it's just that she doesn't have the need, so to speak, to own it. And no, she's been saying she wants me to get someplace, you know, at an antique store or wherever, and just keep moving the stuff down there and see if anybody will buy it. But we've given pieces. We give pieces fairly often to charity auctions and the like.
How about the talk show host?
Yeah, right.
Do you ever do that?
Depends on how nice they are. Depends on how hard the questions are.
I'm bending over backwards here.
I know. You know, speaking of compliments, you are, and you're a very bright, very perspicacious guy with a wide range. Well, the very fact that you can interview so many people so successfully,
I'm good looking,
Steve,
too, Topper.
Yeah, well, now you are that, too.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you, you are invariably nice. I've noticed on your shows, you could have the most obnoxious, and perhaps you do right now, guests, and you just are just a sweetheart about it.
Well, let me just be really honest. You are a talk show host dream guest. I mean, you are delightful to have in here. You could come here every day for a month. I'd be a happy guy, I think, Topper. If you had one piece, what's your favorite piece of art? If you had to get rid of everything, the ship is sinking, what's the one piece you grab?
Well, you know, I guess just because of the value, you'd go back to that the modified Warhol, the Mao, the Mao.
The one you defaced.
Yes, but I right exactly. That's not maybe the term I would use, but there are. There again, I'm not. We have a piece that I look at a lot. We have a lot of the local artists and. Wilbert Newald, who was the head of the painting department at Kansas City Art Institute, we have a piece of his that my wife bought for me, and I look at it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
We have a couple.
You have some of Peregrin's pieces too,
yes,
right?
Yes, mm-hmm. That's right. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Let's do this. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue. I'm thinking I've been doing this show for 10 years. Where have you been? I mean, we needed to have you in here before now. This is terrific.
Well, you're kind to say it.
Yeah.
Thank you.
John Topper Johnson is our guest. We'll talk in our second half about some of his very amazing adventures, and you won't believe some of these things. We'll also visit later on this hour with the great tenor Nathan Graner. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we're we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's futuristic look at how minds will meld with digital brains, you can find it, our weekend to-do list, and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On Monday, a talk with meat eater Stephen Ranella, who lives in Brooklyn and feeds his family from hunting trips all over North America. This hour, we're visiting with John Topper Johns. He's one of the area's most prolific art collectors. He's also a great adventurer, and that's where we're going to turn our conversation now. What's this? Eric had this in the piece. You just mentioned it off mic here, this bed of nails thing. You learned how to lie down on a bed of nails.
Well, I mentioned...
Why'd you do that?
Well, first of all, I mentioned it because I don't know how he found out. maybe one of my sons. Well, what I really wanted to do, Steve, was I and another guy used to do magic, and we would do. I mean,
I love magic.
You talk about balls. I mean, it was crazy that we would do this, but we just somehow didn't realize how bad we were. I think, and we and because we were free, we really got. I mean, we would. I remember performing in Topeka once at a couple thousand people. It was some convention or the like.
Well, I used to do some of that. What's your favorite? What's your big trick?
Oh, I don't know. Because I tend to do, if it's nowadays, I just don't do much anymore, but card tricks, I think.
Oh,
is
that's
sort of thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, I had the idea because a lot of it was comedy magic, and a lot of it, you appeared to get hurt pretty badly. In fact, we would do shows for Cub Scout pack meetings where there'd be several dens. And I have a whole series of things, each one of which made it look like I was hurting myself more than the last. One of which is just a great one. If you know magic, it's a hat pin you pass around and everything, and it's long and it's sharp. And then you roll up your sleeve and keep your hand away, and you stick it through, and blood starts coming out and all. And I remember one time one of my younger son's classmates, it was his birthday party, and these kids were all yelling phony, phony thing because, you know, they figured I really wasn't thinking it through. I turned my arm around, and it was, and you could see that it was all the way through the arm and blood coming out on both sides. They all, literally, immediately, you couldn't have yelled fire and gotten them out of there faster. It was just amazing. But anyway, one of the things I thought I might be able to learn to do, but I'm just too type A to learn it, was to lie on a bed of nails and put a rock on top of my chest and then have somebody hit it with a sledgehammer. And, you know, I taught physics, actually, at one time. And Newtonian physics says that a body at rest will stay at rest. And if it's heavy enough and was a kind of rock, you'd have to know some geology, too, that it would first absorb it, the blow, so mm-hmm. that it wouldn't knock you into it, impale you into the bed of nails.
Hopefully,
right. Mm. Well, see, I never got that far. But the secret of the bed of nails, frankly, is that you can imagine if you lie down and you've only got two nails, you will go through because the pounds per square inch on those two.
Right.
If you put in four, you wouldn't go quite so deeply into them. If you put in 100, you're finally getting. So you literally, even though they're very sharp individually, it's not too bad. Not too bad.
So you've done it.
Yeah, I still have it in my attic.
Well, I used to eat fire. How's that for?
Yeah, I can't do that. I mean, I've never learned. That's great, though.
Yeah,
that's great. No.
One of your adventures, and some of these things are just amazing. You once bungee jumped out of a hot air balloon over the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah,
how high in the air were you?
Well, it would have been, very high because we were above the Rockies. It was someplace very close to Boulder, but it was out in the country.
How old were you?
Oh, 50-some, I think.
Old enough to know
better. I climbed
better.
Kilimanjaro when I was 52.
I saw that,
That was
yeah.
a tough, at age anyway. But what made this thing worse was they brought down the guy that went before me, and you knew they have to bring the hot air balloon back down. There's no way you could get back up in the basket.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're dangling. So somebody, as the hot air balloon comes down, has got to catch you. Because otherwise, you're hanging. Well, you might be able to... Your head down. I mean, first you bounce a while, and then they start back down. And because you're up over the Rockies, and the Rockies would tend to be anywhere from 10 to 14,000 feet.
It's a long way down.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But anyway, this guy, I've forgotten what happened to him, but his catcher, and apparently he'd had problems before with his knees or something, but he went down. His catcher went down. So then he got knocked into a whole bunch of stuff, and I was next.
Oh.
So I'm thinking, mine went perfectly well, so I no good story there. But I thought, oh God, what am I got myself into?
What was that like, jumping out of the hot air balloon?
Well, it was terrible, and I tell you, not having the
terrible.
I have something less than a long inseam, so we put it that way. And honestly, Steve, once I got up there, if they didn't have me already on the outside of the basket, there's a kind of a door, but it's just the point is, I was on the outside holding on and looking down. I don't think I could have made myself kind of climb over to jump. Maybe they've learned that you just have to be on the outside of the deal.
Man, you climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, as you mentioned. That's 20,000 feet and obviously a lot different from climbing Everest. But I understand it's still a magnificent way to spend some time.
Yeah, it is. And they say you shouldn't go with a loved one. Linda did not go with me. Because you do lose, apparently, you lose just like you do when you drink alcohol and or you say you temporarily drowned for a moment in a swimming pool. You lose some brain cells and you do tend to start hallucinating. And it's a very emotional experience. If you wanted to write a great poem or the like, I think just go to the Kilimanjaro or something, because you can cry at a moment's notice. Part of it, you're crying because you're so miserable. But the views are amazing. The worst day of my life, seriously, the worst day of my life was when we went from 15,500 to 20,000. It was 5 days up and back, but the hard day was 15,000 up to 20,000 and then back down to 12. It was just horrid, you know.
Just a lot of walking that day. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, terrible.
You know, I'd forgotten you once were a member of a group that owned the Kansas City Royals, Topper, for a year and a half from 2000 to 2001, but you never could get the owners of the other Major League Baseball teams to approve the ownership. Why not? What was the hang-up there?
Well, the fix was in, but understandably so, in a sense. What happened is that you have to get the approval of 2/3 of the owners of the American League teams and 1/2 of the National League teams. Mm-hmm. And they meet about 4 times a year and have an agenda. And after Ewing Kauffman died, it was a great structural marvel that they put together to be able to get the ownership into the Kansas City Community Trust and then sell it out of there. But the chair was David Glass, who now owns them. And it was a sensitive matter for reasons that take too long to talk about, that for him to bid initially. There had been some back and forth with him and George Brett and the like. And so he didn't bid the first time. And then there was this group of 40 that did. And we were the high bidders. I mean, Lamar Hunt bid and George Brett had a group and so on. So we were technically the owners, and the contract was signed and it was done, but we had to get this approval. Mm-hmm. And Ewing had always wanted David Glass to be the owner. There's no question about that. And David Glass was a good friend of Bud Siegel, who's still the commissioner of baseball.
Right.
So every time they'd meet, and our leader was a guy named Miles Prentice. Do you remember him?
Sure.
He would get excited, like if I go into a singles bar and there's Marilyn Monroe and I say, "Watch me, boys," and I just come out striking out time and again. He'd say, "I'm just sure they're going to take it up this time," and he just acted like it's done, and. They wouldn't even have it on the agenda. So then we'd wait a few months, and they wouldn't put it on again. And it became apparent after about, it might have been even almost 2 years, that they weren't even going to take it up. And that so the trustees, and that would have included David Glass, but he probably reclused himself. He probably did not.
Why were you interested in the Kansas City Royals?
Oh,
topic?
I don't know. I've always loved sports and It wouldn't have been it would have turned out to be a good investment. But anyway, it was just interesting to me.
What do you look for in a good adventure?
Well, I'm getting older, but
Until last year,
I always climbed a 14er once a year.
In Colorado.
Uh-huh. And there were 4 of us originally, all from the same class in college and all. One who's a physician in Boston, he comes out, but he has not been able to make it for the last 10 years, really. It's just gotten too hard for him. But a year ago, the kinder of the two that I climbed with, both of whom live in Denver, was taking me to the airport, and I think they decided that he would give me the little come to Jesus. He said, "Topper, I think the time has come." And what they really meant was that because those two living out there, and they're both in excellent shape, mm-hmm. they could probably, kept going. And I kept thinking I could too. But I'd fallen a couple of times coming down, and it is I tell you, I must have an amazing streak of good luck or just fall like a drunk or a baby, because I don't seem to get hurt very badly, but I did. It was obvious that it's just getting too hard.
How hard was it for you to get that news that maybe the time had come?
Well, it was hard because I got so much mileage out of it at cocktail parties, you know. I was devastated when Eric said. Eric said that it was up until the last few years. Well, no, I want you to know that in July, you can only climb in about 2 months. There's so mm-hmm. much snow, you can't you can't do it otherwise. But in July of 2011, see, I actually did the last one. But I'll give you a good example, too, of how everybody fades. We climbed Mount Harvard. We failed at Mount Harvard about 28 years ago, and then the second time we got lost. And then the second time we climbed it. And it was very, very difficult, but nonetheless, we made it in one day. It's the only one we ever duplicated. We climbed 27 of them out of the 54. There are 54. But the way we made it the second time, and the three of us, the fourth didn't, is that six horses brought up to 11,000 something. We climbed it 11,000 something. But they brought up a bunch of,
provisions
and everything. And then we started at about 11.5, and it's 14.4, and went up to 14.4 and back the next. So we slept one night, mm-hmm. and then up and back, and then slept a second night and came back down. And it was just, it was horrifically enervating. And I thought to myself, it was, but, 20-some years ago that it did it all in one day.
Yeah. Well, you seem to have a zest for life that you just don't come across very often. I mean, where did that come from in your life?
I don't know. I think it's Eric certainly hit it, and it's amazing. Eric was not with me very long, and I'd hate to.
It doesn't take long to figure you out.
Well, I'm telling you, though, that I'd hate to be lying to him. I think he'd see right through it. I do have a lot of energy, mm-hmm. and so when people ask me about what do you do when you retire, I always initially say to them, "Oh, you'll find plenty of things," but that's not necessarily true. My father had difficulty. His business was his whole life, and mm-hmm. So it was.
You once held a car door open for Princess Grace, Grace Kelly of Monaco,
very close to where she died. Yeah,
how did you do that?
Well, I was just over there. I was in the Navy.
Just drop by the house or what?
But to show you that, she was she drove up, and I just and they were somebody was there was it was just totally unlike today. This would have been in 1959, I'm guessing, or something like that. And her driver, and they wouldn't have, there might have been a bodyguard, but just virtually nobody got out, and I just ran up and opened it.
And what did she say to you?
I don't remember. Nothing. Nothing
extraordinary?
Leave me, scum. I don't know what she said, actually.
Well, somebody who did say something sort of interesting to you, you've been in the room and been photographed with the two richest persons in the world, and one of them was Warren Buffett. What did he whisper to you in your ear?
Well, he whispered, he did say that they'll think I'm giving you a stock tip. he is truly my hero. You talk about somebody that is a great interview. He's magnificent. But he is just, I follow him. I worship him. And his bodyguard stories are that he never had them at all. And then he told me that he only started getting them for the weekend of, there's an annual meeting, and there's a ton of people that all go to Omaha. We do too. My whole family goes, my whole extended family, eight of us. It's like a religious pilgrimage. And I go by his house. Nowadays, I'm trying to say this fast, but he finally has gotten, he's now got a bodyguard all the time. But I would go by just like an absolute stalker. And Linda knows him. It was embarrassing to her because I'd slow down and I'd watch. I've been by his house more times than
I've been. It's a very ordinary house,
right? It is an ordinary. He bought it for, in 1956, he bought it for about $36,000. He's added a little bit to it. But mm-hmm. That's just one of the wonders of the man, is that other than owning, and he's very, very precise about how much he pays the company and all because he owns the company for the use. But he does have a private jet, but that's it. I mean, he's the plainest human being in the world.
You know, as a divorce attorney, which is what you did during your career, you represented two different Playboy magazine Playmates of the Month.
That's right.
And
yeah.
Also two state governors, a U.S. senator, a University of Kansas chancellor, and numerous professional athletes. Give me some dish here.
Well, let's see, what can
what about
you do?
The Playmates?
Well, you know, isn't that interesting that there would be, and we're not talking about Playmates like that are in the club,
yeah,
but the actual Playmates of the Month
in the magazine.
Of whom there can only be, you know, 12 a year.
Yeah.
And two of them ended up in Kansas City, so to speak. One actually went to K-State, and the other one I've forgotten what the situation was, but there's a certain amount of, you know, there's a confidentiality on these things. But, I got a call
here
once from the guy, what's his name, that is the co-founder of Home Depot. Anyway, he was flying in a private plane above Atlanta, where he lives, and he had a guy who was the head of his, one of the big regions of Home Depot. I mean, it's one of the very high up deals. And he was concerned because the guy was dating this other Playmate of the Month that I'd represented.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted me to kind of analyze what, I mean, he thought this guy was going to get in trouble. This was not a match made in heaven. And here I was, you know, you're not supposed to say much. And I certainly allowed as how that he may well be right, that her mental health was not the best, perhaps.
Just a final point here. You've eaten octopus, ostrich, eel, rattlesnake, turtle, alligator, oxtails, elk, calves' tongues, brains, intestines, pancreases. That's the plural of pancreas, I guess. And cheeks, pigs' stomachs, turkeys' testicles, buffalo testicles, and pigs' testicles. Now, why'd you do all that?
Well, sometimes it's almost just in front of you, or you just do it for a sense of adventure.
Not in front of me.
But they used to have, they'd call them Rocky Mountain oysters, but testicles fried, you know how the old joke goes, everything tastes a little like chicken? Well, they don't exactly. It tastes a little like chicken livers.
A little twist on that, eh?
And I think, too, you know, we've all got this idea that we could be just a little more masculine if we swallowed testicles from time to time. Who knows?
Well, John, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, Topper. What a great interview. What a great time. I sure enjoyed having you.
You're very kind. Thanks.